Welcome back to our statewide conversation with Minnesota state officials. Today, we're talking to Director of Infectious Disease at the Minnesota Department of Health, Chris Ayersman. It's your opportunity to ask questions about Minnesota's response and plans during the current COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Heidi Holt, and I'm live from the KEXE studios on the Mississippi River in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, on this beautifully warm and possibly 70-degree November day. If you didn't get a chance to send or call in your questions this week, you can email covid@ampers.org or call 612-562-9895. We are teaming up with the 18 community radio station of Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota communities, as well as the Minnesota Broadcasters Association to bring you COVID-19 information for the state of Minnesota. Chris Ayersman, thank you so much for being back with us and taking time to answer listener questions today.
Oh, I'm happy to join you.
So I think we need a reality check. We need to start with where we are at. The numbers just came out a half hour ago. The new daily case rate, 5,454. That is stunning. I wonder if you can put some context in that for us.
It is absolutely stunning, and I can tell you that we, too, were shocked. I mean, we know that the case numbers will be going up, and we've known that, and we've been saying that for weeks, actually, that, you know, we're not seeing the type of cooperation that we need to have transmission slow. But we thought that we might, you know, move from the 3,000 to the 4,000, and we absolutely blew past 4,000 and are in the mid, you know, 5,000s with our cases. So that is a record. The number of deaths we reported today, 36, is also a record. But these are not records that we want to be breaking, and we're very concerned. And I think you've heard that our healthcare systems are really feeling the impact of this, and so it's really quite serious, and it's really important that the public recognizes that.
Where is the spread coming from? What areas of the state?
We're seeing the spread across the state, but actually the increased rate of spread is actually greater in greater Minnesota. Now, obviously, in any one particular county, that's going to be less than, say, a Hennepin County in the metro just because of the population density. But the rate of spread is actually increasing in greater Minnesota more than it is in the metro areas.
And what about communities of color, indigenous people? What kind of spread are you seeing there?
Well, we know that those are populations that are disproportionately affected by COVID. And so, yes, we are seeing cases in those populations as well. And so they are being hit harder. And when we look at the severity of their disease and the outcomes, so that's concerning to us. I think it's important to note, too, that we're continuing to see cases, large number of cases in our young adult populations. And so that is a concern. You know, we've been emphasizing our mitigation messages. And I think as important as they are, people sort of brush them aside. But you know what? We'd rather have you wear a mask and make sure that you're social distancing and avoiding, you know, large groups and congregating together. We'd rather have that than have these very, very high case numbers that put us in a really precarious position as a state. You know, we've seen what's been happening in our neighboring states, and it's quite sobering.
You and Commissioner Malcolm have been reminding us that this spread is due to people getting together in houses or in groups. It's not widespread through long elderly care or that kind of a thing. I wonder if you could explain that more fully for us, and then what is and what isn't safe right now?
Well, I think just to clarify, I mean, what we've been seeing, you know, early in the course of the pandemic, we were seeing some very concentrated outbreaks. We had some large outbreaks in meatpacking plants. We certainly saw very, very a large number of cases in our long-term care facilities. And so there were some really more specific outbreaks that were really driving the large case numbers. And what we've seen since probably July, we started to see an increase in what we call sort of unaccounted for community transmission. That means that, you know, people that are out in the community and they can't identify that they've been exposed to a particular person with COVID. They don't have a clear potential exposure. And that really, really high level of community transmission is really what has concerned us. And certainly, you know, as schools have been back in session, colleges and universities, all of those things that include necessary mixing of people, all of that has contributed to this increased spread. But it's just to be clear, it's not, you know, one particular event that's driving the numbers up. It's lots of little things. And the one thing that I want to emphasize is that while we did see our numbers in long-term care go down over the summer and into September, we have seen those numbers increase with the increase in overall cases in the community, and they are now rivaling what we were seeing last May when we were so very concerned. Because even though our long-term care providers and staff have done some really great things to reduce transmission in their settings, there's a limit to what they can do when the spread is so great in the community. So we're pleased about the progress that they've made in infection prevention, and they have access to PPE, and, you know, they've done many, many things to reduce and control transmission and spread in their setting. But at this point, the high level of community spread puts them at risk again.
We are talking with Chris Ayersman from the Minnesota Department of Health on the statewide conversation on COVID-19. One thing I'm a little concerned about, so I'm in northern Minnesota. This is the beginning of a couple of weekends where we see a flood of people come to northern Minnesota for deer hunting. And there are some wonderful, long-standing traditions that families and friends have of getting together at the deer shack and spending the weekend or even the full week together. So weather's going to be good outside. That's good. But a lot of the traditions of a deer camp are being together in a small shack and eating and socializing after the deer hunt. I wonder if you could talk about that and your concerns.
Yes, well, certainly, you know, being together, whether you're deer hunting or doing something, you know, completely different, it's the being together and being together indoors. And a deer shack would fall under that category. So I think if your tradition involves bringing people from many, many households together, that is concerning, and that definitely puts you at really high risk for the potential for transmission. We recommended, you know, that as you're together, that you maintain, you know, the 6-foot distance, that you wear masks. Those are both things that will help to reduce the chance of transmission, whether you're indoors or out. And certainly, if you're outdoors and you can maintain 6 feet of distance, that's great. If you think you won't be able to, then, you know, keep wearing a mask. I don't know if they have camo masks that you can get, but I think that would really be what we would emphasize. And then, you know, if the eating and drinking, make sure you're not sharing utensils or sharing drinks or that type of thing. So those are some things that you can do within the tradition to help reduce the risk.
Yeah. Well, our next question comes from a listener who had read a recent news story. They said that Governor Walz just asked for help from FEMA. Dr. Michael Osterholm says that the situation is very serious and the healthcare system is being stressed to the brink right now, and we are in danger of being overrun by the virus. Is this hyperbole to get money from the federal government? How bad is it in your view?
I don't think that any of those things are hyperbole. You know, we are in a really difficult place in Minnesota. We've seen, 5,000 cases in one day. It would take us weeks to get that many cases earlier in the pandemic. So we are definitely in a very concerning spot. You may be aware that Dr. Birx, who is the White House advisor on COVID, was here a couple of weeks ago expressing, you know, her grave concern over the situation in Minnesota. She had been here a few weeks before that. So, no, these are very real concerns at this point. And so I would say it's not at all hyperbole.
Our next topic, this is kind of a tough one. It's from a nurse who's working on the front line. She said she had posted this on Facebook. In case you didn't know, Metro hospitals are full. Rochester hospitals are full. Duluth hospitals are nearly full. The COVID hospital is still closing. They are transferring their last remaining patients to St. Joe's today while their patients languish in ERs because there's nowhere to admit them. Most hospitals are also working severely short-staffed. This is not okay. This is not safe. I want people to contact the mayor, the governor, the commissioners. What do you think needs to be done that signed a nurse who cares for COVID patients at a local hospital?
No, that's really good that she is sharing her concern. That is something that the commissioner and I have talked about on our, you know, regular media briefings. It's simply that, you know, we've got information on the governor's website about bed capacity, and that's helpful, I mean, to know how many physical beds there are and ventilators and that type of thing. But you need to have staffing to care for the patients. And we have been seeing a large number of our healthcare staff impacted by COVID themselves, exposed in the community. And so that means they need to isolate. Oftentimes their contacts at work then need to quarantine. So we're seeing a huge, huge pressure on our healthcare system. And so it is something that needs to be addressed. And I know that hospital leaders are talking about the things that they can do. And we're certainly at the Department of Health encouraging those conversations because, you know, it is concerning to us. But I think as community members, we have to keep in mind that this is happening because of the spread that's happening in our community. So we've really encouraged people to think that, you know what, I'm going to limit some of my activities, not just for myself, but because I don't want to inadvertently infect a healthcare worker who then won't be there to take care of me if I get sick. And I don't even mean just get sick from COVID. I mean, if I have a heart attack or if I have some other health condition that needs treatment, we need our healthcare workers to be healthy and available. So I'm very glad that she raised that concern.
We had another email from a listener this week. Jim wrote in. He said, I moved my wife into a memory care facility on September 1st of this year. I noticed some lax mask-wearing habits and flagged it to the administration. Some of the staff were wearing their masks in the style of nose sticking out above the mask. I found out during the discussion that they provide disposable masks for their staff and they require them to use a given mask for 5 days. Is this safe? I'm pretty sure it isn't because I've repeatedly seen advice to use a mask once and toss it or wash it. How can this be fixed? Does the state provide masks to facilities or is it up to them to procure them?
Well, Jim, I'm sorry that you had to go through that with your wife, and I'm glad that you're paying attention to the infection prevention work within that facility. Yes, it's very important. What you described in terms of how the masks were being worn is not appropriate. They need to cover the individual's mouth and nose. There are ways that masks can be reused. When there are shortages, you can store a mask in a paper bag. It allows it to dry out, and then, you know, the same healthcare worker would use that mask again on another shift. However, at this point, we do have access to personal protective equipment, particularly masks. They are not in short supply. And so I think, you know, that facility should be looking into making sure that their staff have greater access to personal protective equipment and have the ability to rotate that through. And certainly if you have concerns about the facility, there are ways that you can report those to the department as well. We do have an Office of Health Facility Complaints, but I would certainly reach out to the facility and say that if they're having difficulty obtaining PPE, that we definitely have resources at the state that could help them. But they they should. We're in a place now where personal protective equipment is readily available.
Let's stay on that topic of resources. We're speaking on election week. It's been a long week for everyone. And as we speak, it looks like numbers are favoring Joe Biden, but you can't hold me to that. This question isn't political, but what could be different when it comes to collaboration between federal and state departments? What would be your hope for the future in terms of how Minnesota has help from the federal government?
I think one of the biggest challenges that we've faced as a country has been the lack of a kind of a cohesive plan. Certainly, whenever the federal government provides guidance to the states, in many of the areas that I work, you know, they provide some clear guidance and allow, obviously, for some flexibility because states are different, and even we know in Minnesota, counties can be different. So you have to have some flexibility. But I think what's been challenging with the pandemic is there hasn't been an overarching national approach to things. And so each state has been left to develop their own. And as you know, just looking at our neighbors, there's been a huge difference in terms of the recommendations and the guidance that our neighboring states have undertaken. And I think there would definitely be benefit if, as a country, we had a more unified approach to responding to the pandemic. But having said that, with the recognition and the flexibility that, you know, implementing things in each state needs to be probably a little bit different, but I think that overall message would be really helpful.
That's Chris Erisman. She is the Director of Infectious Disease and Epidemiology from the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm Heidi Holton. It's our statewide conversation on COVID-19. We got a question from Erin this week. She said, it sounds like a huge part of our increase in COVID cases around Minnesota come from people who have the virus and yet they have no idea that they have it and they are spreading it to others. Is that true? And how can you even reasonably deal with this? What are you trying to get across to people? And she goes on to ask, is it wrong for a person with mild symptoms to simply dismiss them as normal cold and allergies, or should they be running out for testing at the slightest sign of feeling under the weather?
That's a really good question, and it does highlight some of the challenges that we face with COVID. And that is the fact that, yes, there is a certain proportion of the population that remains asymptomatic. That means that they develop COVID, they are infectious, but they don't show overt symptoms. And so that's really challenging because, you know, they don't have anything that's a prompt for them to be tested. And that's partly why we keep emphasizing, you know, you need to limit your interactions with people. You need to really make sure that you're not, you know, seeing many, many people, because there will be people who have no desire to spread COVID to you but may not realize that they're infectious. Having said that, I think we know that people, you know, who have COVID are infectious for 48 hours before their symptoms start. So if you do have symptoms, yes, it is really important that you get tested, because if you can find out quickly that you have COVID, that confirms that, yes, I have COVID and I was probably infectious. And there's people who need to know that so that they can take action so that we can, you know, slow down the spread of this virus. So that's why the state has opened up so many no barrier testing sites. You know, we want people to have access to testing because we know that some people won't have symptoms, some people will have very mild symptoms, and everything we can do to identify those individuals who are positive for COVID, isolate them, and notify their contacts is really beneficial.
You know, it gets really interesting because, of course, our somewhat normal lives have to go on. So I had talked to someone this week who said they needed someone to come in and fix the furnace in their house. And the person who did was coughing and sneezing a lot. And though she didn't feel those symptoms, she got one of the at-home saliva tests just to be sure, because you kind of start to feel like you have a sore throat or that kind of thing when you get worried about these things. I wonder if you could explain a little bit more about all the options that we now have as Minnesotans in terms of testing.
Certainly. Well, yes, there are a number of different options. One, obviously, is to go to your, reach out to your normal health care provider, if you have insurance, to talk to them and get tested that route. And there certainly are benefits to that, because if you do have symptoms, it's good to have an evaluation by a healthcare professional, so that it's, you know, it's not just a test result, that you're getting that medical evaluation as well. But we do have no barrier sites that have been opened up across the state. There's one in Duluth at the DEC, and we're continuing to open those sites up. Then in addition to that, there's also the ability to, yes, request a saliva test, you know, online, get the materials. You'll get instructed via the internet of how to use the test, and then you send it back and can get results that way. There also have been stand-up testing sites. So what that is community testing, in which there will be testing offered for several days for a particular community for a short period of time. And so that is also happening. So there are a number of different options for testing. We're looking also at the ability to increase the availability of testing using antigen tests and point-of-care tests, but there are, you know, there's some need for evaluation to make sure that the testing is used in the right way and that we fully evaluated the sensitivity and specificity. So we're looking at that, but we're working on ways to get testing more readily available across the state.
And you can find information on testing at the Minnesota Department of Health's website, health.state.mn.us. We heard from Sally from Mound this week. She emailed her question to covid@ampers.org. She said, "I was a pretty stressed out person during the first 6 months of this pandemic, but somewhere around the 6 month mark, I seemed to have turned a corner and I hit my stride. I was just accepting the new reality of limiting where I go when I leave the house, limiting who I see, having protocols, supplies, expectations for every member of my family." She said, "Now I'm thinking about what I need to do over the next 6 to 9 months to make it through this strange time in our lives. Does the health department have ideas about that, or are you guys all focused on the day-to-day crisis of the," which she's quoting, "a raging pandemic?"
Well, definitely we are focused on the raging pandemic, but we do think about, you know, what toll this is taking on people and what they're going to need to do to kind of get through the next month. And I think what this listener has described is exactly kind of the mindset that people need to have is, you know, there are many things that you still have access to. I mean, you can still get your groceries. You can, you know, you still have the ability to go out to eat. If you are careful and, you know, take precautions. So not everything in our lives is gone, but many things that give us satisfaction have had to be modified. And I think if you can think that this is going to be necessary for a while longer, the light that we see at the end of the tunnel is availability of a vaccine. And that won't be an immediate, answer to solve every problem. But once we have the ability to reduce disease and to help slow transmission, that will ultimately allow us to get a handle on this. So I think if people can think that this is not forever, that it is for a number of months more, and kind of perhaps look to the winter with a hibernation mode in mind and know that in the next month there will be some positive things that will be coming as it relates to COVID.
Yeah, there have been positive things. I mean, think of how much more testing we have now. There was news this week about vaccines, about vaccine trials. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you know about that?
Yes. I mean, in Minnesota, the state health department, along with our local and tribal partners, have been planning for making sure that when vaccine does become approved and available, that we are ready to be able to distribute that across the state. Our priority, obviously, is to make sure that any vaccine that is offered in Minnesota is a safe one. We know that there are two manufacturers that are very close, Pfizer and Moderna, that are very close to having a vaccine available. They need to make sure that they have data from the clinical trials that includes 2 months of post-vaccination data. When we look at, you know, data over time on vaccine safety, we know that being able to evaluate what happens in those first 2 months after vaccination is really important. So they will need to have that ready before they can go to the FDA. But we know that they're working on that, and that in the next weeks that we expect that there will be a manufacturer that goes to the FDA to seek approval for a vaccine. We know that when the vaccine is first approved, that it will be in very limited supply. And so, you know, the federal government, the Advisory Committee on ACA on Immunization Practices will be making recommendations of who should be initially prioritized, likely healthcare workers. And we have a team in Minnesota that's looking at how to allocate early vaccine, you know, ethically and equitably. But we're preparing for that. And so we know that initially it'll be in short supply, but there are many manufacturers that are working on vaccines. And so over the next month, we think that the vaccine supply for COVID should improve. And ultimately, we will get to the point where any of us who want to be vaccinated will have the opportunity.
Now, I hate to continue to put you in the bad guy. You have to give us the bad news all the time, Chris. But, and I know you get this question all the time, but we've made it through Halloween. People made some alterations to how they did things. People are wondering about the realities of the holidays and how they go about doing this. Can it be safely done?
Well, I think that there are some options to minimize risk. I mean, I think it's always important to know that, you know, I kind of say, well, if everyone just stayed in their bedrooms and never came out, that would be the safest. That's not particularly realistic. And so the guidance that we provide is intended to reduce risk. It doesn't eliminate it, but it reduced it. And so what we've been saying for the holidays is that you really want to make sure that you are limiting the number of people that are being brought together. And that's a challenge for Thanksgiving, because oftentimes for families, it's all the aunts and uncles and cousins and their families all coming together. This is not the year to do that. I think you want to make sure that you're limiting the number of different households that are coming together and limiting the number of people. We've said, you know, roughly 10 people and limit the number of households. Now, I want to be clear, if you have 7 people in one family and 4 in another, and it's 11 people in 2 households, that there's nothing magic about that 10. But the intent is to make sure that you're, you know, limiting numbers and limiting the mixing of households. And you might want to consider, you know, setting up separate tables so you're all together. But if you normally had a card table for the kids, maybe what you want to do is have a card table that's one family and then a card table for another family. You're still together, but you're with the time when you're not wearing your masks and socially distancing, then it's within your household. And we would recommend that people continue wear masks indoors and socially distance, you know, when they're together for the holidays, particularly when you're getting together with people who are outside of your own household. So I think there are things that you can do. It doesn't mean that you can't get together, but you may need to modify how you do that to reduce the risk of COVID transmission.
It seems strange, but I hear from people sometimes that they, you know, they really want to see the people that they love in their lives, their friends or their family, and they kind of just think, well, we're in the same family, even if we don't live together, so we're probably fine. Or they don't want to ask those kinds of questions of where that family may have been. And so it's tough to make those decisions, but a quiet Thanksgiving and Christmas holiday might be the best way to go.
Yes, and I think it's important that you have those conversations, because the other thing is that different members of the family may have different perspectives on risks and concerns, and I think you need to make sure that you're respecting the risks of the concerns of the people who have risk of severe disease. And certainly if you have elderly family members or family members that have a number of underlying health conditions, you really need to think about if they should be part of the get-together or if that should be virtual. I think those are important things to have conversations about in advance of the holiday.
It's Chris Ayersman for the Minnesota Department of Health, Director of Infectious Disease Epidemiology, Prevention and Control Division. Chris, thank you for your time, your knowledge, and the direct answers today. We appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Broadcast a collaboration of community radio stations throughout the state in partnership with AMPRS, Diverse Radio for Minnesota Communities, as well as the Minnesota Broadcasters Association. Listen to the full conversation, KEXE.org, or if you want to ask a question next week, email COVID@AMPRS.org or call 612-562-9895. I'm Heidi Holton for KEXE, KBXE. Thanks so much for listening.